Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today, I am honored to be joined by Jacob Hornberger. He is the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, and we are going to discuss Human Action, a treatise on economics by Ludwig von Mises. Mr. Hornberger, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome. Nice to be here with you, Keith.
Before getting into Human Action, we have another book that just came out, An Encounter with Evil, the Abraham Zapruder Story, that FFF has just come out with. What is your thesis behind this book?
Well, I know I'm biased, but I consider this the best work that I've done in the 32-year history that I've been with the Future of Freedom Foundation. It's on the Kennedy assassination, which a lot of people know that I've written a lot about, and principally in my books, The Kennedy Autopsy and The Kennedy Autopsy 2. But last summer, I came across a book that was written by a woman named Alexandra Zapruder, who is the granddaughter of Abraham Zapruder, the Dallas businessman who just by happenstance went out and happened to film the entire assassination of John F. Kennedy there in Dealey Plaza in Dallas. And so I purchased the book thinking, well, this would be an interesting read just to kind of see what the family history is about. The title of her book was 26 Seconds, A Personal History of the Zapruder Film. Well, as I started reading it, Keith, I realized, oh, it's much more than that. She started disclosing some family secrets that I found very intriguing, especially given my law background. She said that there was a family taboo for around 50 years against discussing the Zapruder film within the Zapruder family. Now, she says it's not really a taboo. She called it a code or a culture, but it was the same thing. And she said, well, there wasn't an express prohibition against discussing the film, but it was developed as a code or a culture that was not to happen. So she decided after 50 years to violate that code and start researching and trying to understand what this was all about. And so she came up with two what I consider totally ridiculous reasons for this taboo. And so as I'm finishing this book, I'm thinking, oh, she didn't achieve what she thought she was going to achieve. And she even acknowledged in the beginning that she was scared to do this, that because of what she might uncover. Well, it's a justified fear, because whenever you have a family taboo, there's usually a dark secret behind it. But she didn't uncover that dark secret. She came up with two inane explanations for it. So I made it my quest to figure out what is going on here. What is this dark secret within the Zapruder family that caused this taboo to come into existence? And so I built my book around that. It's essentially a mystery, but it's in the larger context of the Kennedy assassination, the Cold War, the severe anti-Russia animus that still guides us today. So I wanted a book to show people, why is this assassination so relevant to what's going on today? How does understanding that assassination provide us with the way to get out of the morass in which we find ourselves, which is death, destruction, war, foreign policy crises, chaos? And how do we get back on the road to peace, prosperity, liberty, and harmony with the people of the world? So that's the most important thing in the context of developing this mystery and uncovering, which I am convinced is the dark secret behind this family taboo. I explain to people why this assassination is so relevant to what's going on today and how it provides the way to get out of the morass in which we find ourselves.
The book is An Encounter with Evil, the Abraham Zapruder Story. Links to the book will be in the description below. Starting with part one of Human Action, the book is broken down into seven parts. Part one is titled Human Action. It goes over the fact that humans act, time preference, uncertainty, and marginal utility. What is the importance of recognizing that human beings act?
Well, first of all, keep in mind that I'm not an economist. I was a lawyer by training. I practiced law for some 12 years, but I was an economics major. And I have read and studied Human Action. It is an absolutely monumental achievement. I think it's the greatest economics treatise that's ever been written. I mean, I would highly advise it for everybody. Now, it's a very difficult read. And I've read it through more than once. And when I get to the parts that I just do not understand, I just keep going. So that's sort of a a counsel to people that tackle human action, that you're going to get to areas where you say, oh my gosh, I have no idea what he's talking about here. But don't stop and set aside the book. Just keep going, because you'll inevitably hit areas where you do understand it, where it makes sense. Now, when I was in college and I was an economics major, it was the standard charts and graphs, supply curves, demand curves, equilibrium points. And I remember thinking one time, how does this relate to real life? I mean, let's assume that I was not going to law school, which I'd already planned to go. How would I use these charts and graphs? And I thought, well, maybe when people go into stores, you can figure out what a supply curve is or a demand curve. It's like, it just didn't make any sense to me in a practical sense, that it was the standard Keynesian type model building. Well, then I discovered Austrian economics and principally human action, and everything changed for me. Now, all of a sudden, things started to make sense, because Mises starts out the book, this Ludwig von Mises, he starts out the book with what you said. Human beings act. They make choices in life. And through those choices, all kinds of things happen. Well, now this starts to make sense to me, because now I can relate to it. Yeah, of course that's what's happening in a market economy or in just real life. Human beings are waking up in the morning, they're going to work, they're receiving salaries, they're saving their money, they're spending their money. You've got markets that are coming into existence. There's price, the price system that comes into existence. People have to determine, you know, should I buy this? Do I want to buy that? Well, it's a little bit too expensive. And through this process, you start to understand economics, because economics, as Mises is talking about, is human action. It's not demand curves and supply curves. It's a study of what happens when human beings act.
That is so important, because if you think of it as economics is this thing, it has to do with GDP and a lot of, you know, supply and demand numbers. It's better off people like Paul Krugman, those experts can focus on that. There's nothing really much I can do in this area. That is so disarming to the average person, as opposed to every time you act, you engage in choices using the scarce resources of your time, money, or body. And this is you economizing. For every minute you spend talking about human action is 1 minute you're not sleeping or exercising or doing something else. So right off the bat, we can see why it actually matters and why it's important. Totally different from everything else. I had read Paul Samuelson's Economics Introduction. So that's what I liked about this book so much. I also like in the introduction, he goes over the limits of empiricism. So it's not that we have to do a study every time we want to talk about the minimum wage. We can actually approach these things logically and get a pretty good understanding of where of what's likely to happen if you artificially increase the price of labor. Do you have any ideas or any important things you want to tell people about the limits of empiricism and the importance of praxeology as an economic approach, instead of always having to study everything?
Yeah, I mean, near the end of the book, he talks about the crisis of interventionism. And Mises had written another book called, I think, something of the crisis of interventionism, something like that. And what he's talking about is that when you see these crises that take place in a market economy, they're almost always caused by government intervention. When he's developing the market economy and the concept of the market economy and the price system, he's really building on what Frederick Bastiat called natural harmonies. Now, Bastiat was, of course, the 19th century French free market libertarian legislator who wrote these fantastic books on economics. But he was a classical economist, 19th century. But he talked about natural harmonies that develop between people, that people are dovetailing their own interests, their own choices with other people that are doing the same thing. And they're in the process of this, they enter into trades with one another. Now, you have 10 apples, I have 10 oranges. Hey, let's do some exchanging here so that you can have some of what I have and I can have some of what you have. And so by entering into these trades, we improve our standard of living. And Mises points out in the early part of the book that choices involve trying to improve your condition in life, that people are never just content with what they have. I mean, I guess you could find some, priest somewhere that's taking a vow of poverty that might be totally content, or a nun or something. But most people, they want to improve their happiness in life. And that involves choices. Should I do this? Should I do that? And so you've got this natural harmony that develops in this market economy without any government intervention. This is just what happens naturally. And you've got this intricate price system where people start using money instead of just barter. They start turning to a third item that's more readily accepted. Well, then the government comes along and says, oh, well, we need to intervene here because workers are not getting paid enough money. This natural system you're talking about isn't working. And so we need to intervene for a minimum wage. Well, as Mises points out, this produces all kinds of disharmonies, that all of a sudden you're putting people out of work because you've set that minimum at too high a level, at the higher level than what the natural market would do. And employers aren't going to pay that. And let's say, for example, they make the minimum wage $100 an hour. Well, employers are going to say, we can't pay that. We're going to go out of business if we do that. Well, tough luck. You got to do it. Well, Mises is saying these are the disharmonies of the market economy. So when you engage in all this statistical analysis where you're saying, oh, well, let's look at the numbers and let's get government involved in rectifying this problem or that problem, that's where the problems originate, is with government intervention. So instead, as Mises develops the process in human action, he's talking about what happens. Let's study when human beings act and how this results in higher standards of living for everyone.
Using the insights you've gained from human action, how would you explain to someone who says, okay, we have an end. We want healthcare. We want access to education. Why should I take the free market route as opposed to the politician route of the state representing us and providing goods on our behalf?
Well, this comes into play the concept of central planning, government central planning, which Mises is very critical of. And he's even more critical in his book, Socialism. But he has a section on central planning. What you're talking about here is that government officials decide that the market is inefficient, that it's failing in a certain area. It's not providing health care for everyone. And so they feel like, oh, well, the government now needs to intervene. And they're going to centrally plan the healthcare system. Well, as Mises points out, and as Hayek, his protege, Friedrich Hayek, pointed out, who won the Nobel Prize in economics, is that this results in what's called the fatal conceit of the planner. That the government official thinks that he has the requisite knowledge to plan a very complex field. And we see this not only in healthcare, we see it in education, that education is the concept of central planning. That's why there's always a crisis whenever you see central planning, because in a market economy, you have each individual deciding what's in his best interest. And he's pursuing his goals as he sees fit. Well, a lot of, and this is gets back to choices, a human being's act. But he's doing this as he's processing constantly changing conditions in his life. I mean, prices are changing. Businesses are going out of business. Businesses are coming into existence. There's new options arising. He goes to the internet and he says, okay, well, boy, I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. And his valuations are constantly changing, but he knows what's best for himself. He can figure that out. Now, he may make mistakes in retrospect, but at the moment that he's acting, he's making decisions that are designed to say, what can I do that's best for me? The central planner can't do that. The central planner is sitting up in Washington. He doesn't know what's in the minds of each individual actor. It's impossible for him to do that. He cannot factor in, as he's making his plan, his healthcare plan, what are the constantly changing conditions that are applying to each individual. And so what ends up happening is you end up with what Mises called planned chaos, which is another title of a great little book he has called Planned Chaos. that it's you end up with this chaotic system, and that's where we have this chaos in healthcare. I mean, we've had a constant crisis in healthcare ever since the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in the 1960s. And instead of getting rid of the original cause of the crisis, this is another point that Mises makes when he talks about interventionism, that instead of getting rid of the original cause, inevitably the government officials double down. And they say, well, we now need to reform this system that we brought into existence. And so they're constantly reforming healthcare. And that's ultimately what Obamacare was all about, is designed to fix the problems with the previous intervention. Well, it doesn't work. And so that's why the planners are now calling for a full-fledged socialist healthcare system, like in Cuba, where the government runs everything and all the doctors work for the government. Well, that's what ultimately ends up happening, as Mises points out in Human Action, that if you let government start taking over one area, it inevitably leads to more interventions, to more interventions, to more interventions, until you finally have total central planning. And that's why the Soviet Union, part of the reason the Soviet Union collapsed economically, because it was entirely based on central planning. It's a total chaotic system. Now, if I may, I'll throw in here also Mises' tremendous insight on socialist calculation. That and this drove the socialists batty, and it still drives them batty because they don't have an answer to it. That let's say you have a totally centrally planned government-owned society where the government owns everything. Well, how do they calculate things? In a market economy, people calculate because there's prices that come into existence. So you can make a rational decision. Do I want to buy a new car? Well, okay, I've got $20,000 in savings. That new car is going to cost $30,000. Do I want to go into debt? And so forth. But these prices are arising in a market economy where people are trading with one another. It's a natural phenomenon. When you've got the government that owns everything and centrally planning everything, there are no prices that come into existence because nobody's trading anything. It's the government owns everything. There's no trades. And so how does the government rationally calculate in the socialist economy? It can't. And so therefore you have total chaos constantly on a permanent basis, which is of course the situation in Cuba. It was a situation in the Soviet Union. To a large extent, it was the situation in China until they started freeing up their economy several years ago.
It's so sad to see those people coming over from Cuba on those rafts, having to escape and finding refuge in Florida, only to come under the rule of Marco Rubio, who wants to further impose sanctions on Cuba and every other place. They still haven't learned the lessons after all this time. I like the point about how they don't have the information necessary. And, well, very few, if anyone, has the information necessary of what's going on in the heads of everyone else. So you need this profit and loss mechanism. I like how Mises doesn't talk about the business people are the good people, sort of like Ayn Rand almost did a little too much, and the politicians are bad. It's almost like saying it almost would make you think what we just have to do is elect the right people who are smart enough to make this plan. But Mises says, no, even the smartest and the best, when put in that position, will not face this profit and loss sort of healthy corrective mechanism that the market has. I think it's so vitally important there. In part two, he talks about action within the framework of society, talks about social cooperation, the division of labor, the role of ideas, and exchange. Do you have any ideas on the zero-sum fallacy, the idea that when someone gets rich, it is necessarily at the expense of someone else?
Yeah, it's a totally fallacious notion because in every trade, both sides are benefiting. And in Human Action, Mises makes it clear that inequality is a good thing. It's not something that we should lament. It's not something that we should whine about, that there's inequality in society. Now, he makes it clear that he's not talking about inequality under the law. Under the law, everyone should be treated equal. And so we don't want the law to be treating people unequally. If somebody commits murder, we want him to be treated just like everybody else, whether he's rich, poor, politically connected, or whatever. But in terms of a market society, a free market society, everybody's different. Everybody's created different. There's people with tremendous talents, like singing talents or pro football talents or pro basketball talents, or somebody's a tremendous professor or a brilliant person. Other people are not so much. Most people, I think most of us are not the genius type, say to say, or the super talented part. But he celebrates this idea of inequality and says that in the market economy, the way you get rich is by serving consumers. So you may be the most brilliant person in the world, but if you don't give consumers what consumers are willing to pay for, you're not going to get wealthy. That in terms of wealth in the market economy, it's the people who are successful in serving consumers. So you may have the most brilliant professor in the world, Harvard educated, the guy's a genius. He may not make as much money as a pro football quarterback who maybe has just a college degree. Well, that's because you've got consumers that are placing a higher value on pro football and going and paying a large amount of money for that ticket than they're paying for to go to the college where the college professor's teaching. Well, this is something that we should be celebrating. Now, in terms of trade, people enter into trades with one another. And in every trade, everybody, both sides benefit. So there's no zero sum here. That if you've got the 10 oranges and I've got the 10 apples and I give you 9 apples and you give me 1 orange and we both agree on that's the deal, there's no losers here. We're both winners. How do we know that? Well, because in every trade, you give up something you value less for something you value more. So it doesn't have to be a so-called equal trade, 5 oranges for 5 apples. It's where do we find our marginal value in terms of the trade. So when you've got a society where people are trading, even if what statists would call an unequal basis, you've got society's standard of living rising. And notice that you can have a society that's based totally on trade without any factories and so forth, and people's standard of living is rising because everybody's getting something they value less for something they value more. So when Mises talks about inequalities of wealth, he's saying these are people who have traded like their labor services or traded for something that they value. An entrepreneur values something like Bitcoin, and they end up having to buy at the right time or all of a sudden it soars. That people are becoming wealthy in the market economy because they're through consensual trades, they're able to maximize their position better than other people can. But that ordinarily comes about by doing something that satisfies consumers, sort of like Amazon. You know, Amazon is this tremendous business, but notice how they've gotten wealthy, that by serving consumers and providing a product that consumers like and are willing to pay for.
A lot of people will say that competition is necessarily a bad thing. It's sort of dog eat dog as opposed to something cooperative. What are your thoughts, or Mises's thoughts, on the concept of competition versus cooperation? Are these harmonious or antithetical?
Well, they're totally harmonious. And this is one of the big points that Mises builds on. And of course, he's building on what Frederick Bastiat talked about. For example, in his book, Natural Harmonies, he's saying that natural harmony is developed between people and that competition is a good thing. It keeps you on your toes. But as long as nobody's initiating force against someone else, like you see in the drug war, where you have people competing by killing each other, that's what interventionism does. In a market economy, you've got people competing in very mutually beneficial ways. And everybody benefits from this. Consumers benefit because competitors are bringing into existence better products. Keeps you on your toes. Somebody comes along with a better mousetrap and you think to yourself, my gosh, if I'm going to stay in business, I've got to come up with an even better mousetrap than that guy did. Well, in the process, you're doing something that's benefiting you. You're trying to improve your market share. But notice that we're talking about what Mises called consumer sovereignty, that the consumers are sovereign, that everybody exists in the business, in the marketplace to serve consumers. They're the ones driving what's to be produced. And so the competition is to like, is oriented toward who's going to better serve the consumers. And we're all consumers. I mean, we may have jobs. We're producers too. We have two roles. We go to work, but as consumers, we want everybody serving us. We want everybody coming to us and saying, buy my mousetrap, buy my mousetrap. I've got a better product. And with everybody doing this, there's a cooperation that takes place, not a vicious type of thing that we see like in the drug war where people are competing with violence. Instead, they're competing by producing better products that benefit everybody.
Exactly. And there's actual dog-eat-dog competition in the political realm where all these politicians get up and they try to compete who the best liar is, who's the biggest economic illiterate, and that they always continue to impress me.
Let me add to that. They also compete in terms of who's going to steal better than everybody else.
They're competing in the worst ways.
Exactly. They're saying, I'm going to give you more goodies, and they compete on that basis. I'm going to give you this freebie. I'm going to give you that freebie. So like they're competing on how many freebies they give, which is essentially saying I'm going to steal more from the taxpayer than you are, because that's the only way they can get these free benefits or stimulus plans and so forth. And of course, we see that now with the inflation, all the prices at the pump. Those stimulus plans weren't free, but they're competing in terms of how can we best fleece you without you discovering that we're fleecing you.
Yeah. And then they go, well, and we're actually going to have to steal more to educate the kids that it's not stealing. So, oh gosh, all theft leads to more theft. It's a great point about competition actually being cooperation, because even though, you know, you have Red Robin competing with Olive Garden, even in order to get to that stage, Red Robin has to cooperate with employees. It has to meet consumer demand. It has to cooperate with the people who build the building, the construction workers. It has to cooperate with the people who sell silverware, has to cooperate with chefs, all the people who make their menus. So in order to compete, you have to first cooperate with like millions of people, both directly and indirectly. So the idea that the market economy is atomistic individuals doing things by themselves, I don't know. How did that start? I know it's a little segue from the book, but how did they fleece the public into thinking the market economy is doing things by yourself? Government is us doing things together.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And Mises does go into this in Human Action, where he talks about the market is a cooperative process. You've got, you know, countless people that are cooperating together, as you point out, to bring things into existence. There's a great little essay that I would recommend everybody to read. It's called iPencil. And it was by a man named Leonard Reed, who is the founder of an organization called the Foundation for Economic Education, which was really the first libertarian economic foundation, or at least one of the first. And it's the biographical tree of a pencil. And Reed shows that all of the people around the world that cooperate pursuing their own self-interest to produce a pencil. And he says, nobody really knows how to make a pencil. The pencil comes into existence by virtue of all of these individual efforts from all over the world, the people that are making the little rubber for the eraser and the people that are bringing the lead for the inside of the pencil. Well, that's the way the market economy works, as you point out. And here's another important point. You know, the Marxists, the socialists, the interventionists, the statists are always trying to make workers think that their interests are disharmonious with respect to their employer, that there's this conflict, constant conflict. Well, Mises points out that on the contrary, that there is a mutual harmony of interest between employees and employers, because it's in the interest of the employee that business succeed. The more successful that business is in satisfying consumers, the more money that's coming into existence, and which means more money to pay higher wages. If the business starts failing because it's taking a loss in the business, that means workers are going to be laid off. There's no wage increases. But if the business is prospering, then the business has the money to pay higher wages. Now, do we have to rely on the benevolence of the employer? to pay those higher wages? No, that's where the competitive process comes in, because around the corner is another business that's prospering. And if the employer doesn't match the wage increases, he loses his workers, because workers start checking around saying, hey, what are they paying? What are they paying? And if there's a significant difference, they're out of there. And so that's why you can always rely on a market process to have this mutual harmony of interest between workers and employers.
Part three goes over economic calculation, which we discussed. Part four, catalactics, or economics of the market society. Catalactics he defines as the science of exchanges. Part four discusses capital, freedom, inequality, entrepreneurship, profit and loss, prices, monopolies, gold standard, interest rates, credit, trade cycles, and wages. There's so much in that chapter. When it comes to monopolies, walk us through Mises's thought process of responding to the concept of monopolies or oligopolies?
Well, the real monopoly, in the traditional historical sense of the term, is one in which government is intervening. And the government intervenes by having either the government produce a particular product or gives the sole prerogative to a business or an individual to produce a product. And everybody else is prohibited from competing by law. If somebody tries to compete, they will shut him down immediately with an injunction. Your classic example of a monopoly is the Postal Service with respect to the delivery of first-class mail. No one is allowed to deliver first-class mail. No one is allowed to compete. And we've talked about a competitive process. Well, a monopoly prohibits competition. It's saying, we're going to give you the exalted privilege of being able to do this without fear of competition. Well, not surprisingly, monopolists end up being inefficient. They end up being abusive, long lines, the service is lousy. And this has been historically the case. The monopolies go all the way back to the Middle Ages in England, the common law. And people recoiled against monopolies. They hated them because the monopolist acts like a jerk, because he doesn't have to worry about losing business to competitors. So that is your standard definition of a monopoly, where it's a government privilege. It's a legally granted privilege. On the other side, you have big businesses that are arising in a market economy just naturally, where they're satisfying consumers like Amazon, huge business. But it's not because competition is prohibited. It's because it is doing a good job satisfying consumers. Well, people start thinking of this as a monopoly. Well, it's not a monopoly. Monopoly is one, again, where you have government prohibiting competition. As long as there's freedom of entry, that is, the government's not prohibiting entry, you've got competition. Now, you may have one entity that is providing a certain good or service. Even within a community, you may have, let's say, one dry cleaning business that everybody goes to. And it's making a killing. I mean, it's making a lot of money. It's raising its prices. It's the only one in town. That's not a monopoly, because anybody else is free to go in there and open up another dry cleaning business. So we don't, in a market economy, as Mises carefully explains, we don't want to condemn the business. He had a funny little story about the chocolate king. And he says the chocolate king doesn't get wealthy except by satisfying consumers by selling them chocolate. That it's not like the olden days where a king, was just powerful and he could issue orders, you will buy my chocolate. The chocolate king has to produce good chocolate, because otherwise people are going to say, well, I'm not walking in. So that's the difference between bigness in the market economy and monopoly. Let me go one step further and say, you don't need an antitrust law. You've got here the antitrust law of 1890 that came into existence. This was the one of the first moves toward interventionism that Americans ended up adopting in the 20th century. You don't need any trust laws. Just let the market decide who's going to stay in business and who's not going to stay in business. And a classic example of this, Keith, is if you look at the 20 largest businesses in 1970, let's say, the Fortune 500, take the top 20, I'm willing to bet that 17 or 18 minimum are no longer in those top 20. Why? because the market put them out of existence. But back in 1970, they were being called oligopolies, monopolies, big business, General Motors, U.S. Steel, or whoever the big ones were at the time, General Electric. Well, where are they now? You know, they're not in the top 20 anymore. At least some of them are not in the top 20.
Certainly. When it comes to things like capital, this is a big disagreement. People like AOC have brought this to the forefront, saying that there are some people that own so much property and they're just sitting back. Like, so imagine someone in San Francisco sitting in a high rise owns all this property around the world and they don't go there. They don't mix their labor with it. What are the potential benefits of one person being able to own many, many large amounts of property titles?
Well, that's part of a free society, that you're able to buy whatever you want to buy and you're able to hold whatever you want to hold. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to continue doing that. I mean, how many times have we seen children whose father, let's say, or mother were very successful in the marketplace? They build up a great big business and then they pass away and they leave the business to their children. And it's actually a burden to the children. They don't know how to hold on to this wealth. They can't produce wealth. They don't know how to run that business. And so ultimately what ends up happening is they end up having to sell the business or sell an apartment house that they don't know how to run. If you have a large amount of capital, again, you're going to have to be very careful on how you hold it. Where do you invest it? Remember, there's no guarantees in investment either, that you invest in the stock market and all of a sudden the stock market plummets. You recall the stock market crash in 1929, that where people were jumping out of buildings because they lost everything. So you let the market ferret all this out. Now, it appears sometimes that somebody is so wealthy that there's no way that they could lose their wealth, but they can lose a large portion of it. We see that happening all the time. So the market is a dynamic process. The economist Joseph Schumpeter called it creative destructionism, because you do have businesses that are going out of business. They're not satisfying consumers. And so they're laying off workers. But in the process, you're getting rid of businesses that are inefficient. But in the process, the consumers are bringing into existence through entrepreneurial activity, through capital accumulation, other businesses. So, for example, when the automobile business comes into existence, the buggy whip business have a hard time surviving. They end up going out of business. But the people that were working in the buggy whip business are now moving into the automobile industry and making a lot more money in the process. This gets into the area of what we call capital, as you mentioned, and Mises develops this, the importance of capital to rising standards of living. It's everything. I mean, it's why it's called the capitalist system. And if all we do is let government confiscate capital to provide welfare or warfare, weapons to Ukraine or whatever, all you're doing is lowering your standard of living. Because it is through capital accumulation that people become more productive. More productivity means higher profits, more money for the businesses, which means more money being able to pay to workers. And so how does capital come into existence? Mises explains it in Human Action through savings. That when you have a society where people are making a certain amount of money, let's say an annual salary of $40,000, they take $30,000, they spend it, they put $10,000 into savings. That's now capital. They put that into a bank. A farmer goes into the bank and says, I want a tractor to make my workers more productive. Oh, well, sir, we have $10,000 of savings here that we can lend to you to go buy that tractor. And then he buys the tractor. Workers are now producing 10,000 bales of wheat instead of 1,000 bales of wheat. Now we see that standards of living are rising, but because of capital accumulation. And when you have a system where government is confiscating massive amounts of capital for welfare and warfare, it boggles my mind, Keith, that Americans support this, because what they obviously don't realize is that they are supporting their own lower standards of living.
It totally makes sense when you look at the concept of just the fact that people have different talents. So it's it's almost like when you're reading Karl Marx, he talks as though, you know, capitalism has given some good stuff. I mean, look at all these railways and all this. Just imagine how much better it would be once we confiscate it from the capitalists and the laborers are getting the full profit that that they actually deserve. He doesn't assume that the people currently making the decisions are making them more profitably than if the decision makers are totally different. So if you just take the example of a typewriter, that it, just one piece of capital, what percentage of people are able to use a typewriter and come up with something as brilliant as human action? They have the same piece of capital. I'll give one typewriter to Pat Buchanan and one to my neighbor. Pat Buchanan's going to produce something brilliant. My neighbor, not so much. So that's just with one piece of capital. Imagine factories. People have different ideas of how to best meet consumer demand. Just like anything else, the same reason Adele is able to use a microphone and get millions of people. My microphone has yet to get me millions of viewers, but maybe someday it will. Nor would I be able to write something as brilliant about JFK as the JFK autopsy. That was your first one on JFK, right?
The Kennedy autopsy.
The Kennedy autopsy. That's the one I've read. I still haven't gotten to this one. I came across this a long time ago. This is a list. Only these 60 companies were in the Fortune 500 in both 1955 and 2016. So here's this list. Notice on the list, you still have places like Lockheed Martin. You have General Electric, Northrop Grumman. I wonder, is Raytheon on here? Well, Pfizer. And yeah, Raytheon is on here. So even looking at those, you still have examples of there's a high turnover rate in the market. And a lot of these only exist because the military industrial complex continues to fund them. So yeah, this lie that they push about the big companies just get bigger is complete nonsense. I just had to share that because we came across that before.
No, that's great. And your point about Marx is so good because, well, you know, Karl Marx, we're talking about, as Mises points out, that he was a classical economist and his whole concept was based on the labor theory of value. And so he said, you know, the value of any item is based on how much labor goes into producing it. And for, you know, almost a century, that's what everybody believed that. And therefore, it's logical for him to say, well, therefore, everything belongs to the worker. There should be no profits because it's the worker that's producing this value, his efforts are producing this value. Well, then along come the Austrian school and as well as others, William Stanley Jevons and Eugen Walras and Karl Menger, who was the Austrian, all came up with the marginal theory labor of value, marginal utility theory of value, or what we also know as a subjective theory of value, where they said, no, the value of an item is not based on how much labor goes into producing it. It's based on subjectivity. What do people place as a value of theirs in terms of their own subjective feelings? So if you find a diamond that's sitting on the ground and you have another diamond that workers have spent a year digging out of the ground, they're both going to have the same value if they're exactly the same thing. It's a matter of how much value do people place on these things. So that just bursts asunder the whole Marxian theory of everything belonging to the worker. Now we're looking at something much more complex here. And your point is fantastic. If it just boggles the mind, Keith, as to what would have happened had we not adopted a welfare warfare state in America. Now, the welfare state comes into existence in the 30s. The warfare state comes into existence in the 40s. So you've got this massive national security establishment, Pentagon, CIA, NSA. You've got this massive welfare state, Social Security, Medicare, farm subsidies, education grants that have confiscated untold amounts of capital from the American people. Imagine what life would have been like if we had continued on that same trajectory that the country was founded on in terms of economic liberty. We know the horrible exception of slavery, but if once slaves are freed, and they, of course, never should have been enslaved, but everybody's participating in a market economy, keeping everything they earn, no income tax, which is what people lived under here in America for more than 100 years, It boggles the mind what the standard of living of everyone would be, especially for the poorest people in society. That's what they did with this massive confiscation of capital. They reduced the standard of living lower than what it would have been exponentially had they never done that.
Part five, social cooperation without a market. He talks about taxation, socialism, and restriction of production. If you look at the progressive arguments against needing a driver's license to vote, they say, well, the poorest people who have the least amount of opportunities, that sort of puts them, that hurdle stops them from being able to achieve this end called voting. Yet they never apply that to the market economy. They're like, yeah, we need tons of licenses, tons of regulations, and this only helps people. Well, no, just take that same logic of it hurts the poorest if there's all these hurdles to vote. It hurts the poorest to if there's all these hurdles to open up a business. So there's less competition. So there's higher prices. So employees have fewer options. They poison this well just a little bit, and the ramifications are absolutely devastating. Any thoughts on part five, social cooperation without a market?
Yeah, I mean, the point you just made is fantastic, that if the poor ever were to discover that this entire interventionist, regulatory, welfare state way of life was really against their interests, you would see a monumental shift toward the good founding principles of America, a free market, a genuine free market society, and a genuine limited government, as compared to a welfare state, regulated economy, and a warfare state or national security state. And if you look at it like what you mentioned, licensing laws, and Mises points this out, that it's ostensibly they sell them as, oh, we're protecting you against the incompetent hairdresser or the incompetent shoeshine person or the incompetent doctor, lawyer. Oh, if we didn't have licensing, you would have a quack doing brain surgery on you. Well, this is pure nonsense, that it's a way all too often to lock the poor out of the labor market. Mm-hmm. And we see this particularly with respect to hairdressing, that they lock blacks out of the labor market to a large degree because, you know, they blacks get proficient in braiding hair for other blacks, and all of a sudden they don't need to go to a really, you know, expensive hairdresser to do that. They can go to their neighborhood person that's doing it, you know, on the side or something. And oh no, you don't have a license? Oh, you've got to go to cosmetology school and spend $2,000 or whatever to get a license. Well, it's just a racket, and it's a racket in the law business. I was a lawyer. This is all that licensing does, is it limits the supply so that incomes of lawyers will be higher. They don't have to worry about unlimited competition. And that's what licensure is. It's a limitation on supply in that particular business. It's a racket. And they say, oh, well, Jacob, we need licensing laws to protect us against incompetent, unethical lawyers. That's such a joke. I mean, you can find incompetent, unethical lawyers a dime a dozen that are licensed. And doctors, Milton Friedman, who is another libertarian economist who won the Nobel Prize, he wrote a great piece on occupational licensure. I recommend it to everyone. And he tackled doctors. He was says, let's not do shoeshine people or hairdressers. Let's deal with doctors. And so he showed why you don't need licensure in doctors. And if people want to do alternative health care, they should be free to do that. And then you get references from your family physician as to who you need to do your brain surgery, and you get recommendations. You don't just go to the neighborhood quack that's going to start sawing open your head. So if you look at the welfare state, that there's a great book by the late economist Walter Williams called The State Against Blacks that talked about all this interventionism. And again, Mises goes into it in Human Action, that all this interventionism that is supposedly designed to help the poor, minimum wage laws, another classic example, price controls, that it's actually an attack against the poorest people in society. The greatest thing that could ever happen to the poorest people in society is a dismantling of this whole welfare state regulatory society and all the protectionism. You know, we've talked a little bit about trade. We should amplify that and say, we need free trade, not only domestically, but internationally. You mentioned earlier about Cuba. You know, okay, Cuba establishes a socialist society there. All right, we would never advocate that. It produces nothing but chaos and poverty, as we've seen. But as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, the Cubans come over here, and unfortunately, they advocate that America adopt the same system. And that's what the embargo is all about. The embargo is an attack on us as Americans. It puts us in jail for daring to go to Cuba and trade and spend money there. It's just a totally perverse response to what happens in Cuba. You don't fight communism with more socialism, which is what sanctions and embargoes are all about. You fight communism and totalitarianism with freedom and limited government. And that's what we should have done, and we still should do today, is just lift all the embargoes, lift all the sanctions, free the American people to travel and trade anywhere in the world. Those are our best ambassadors. Those are our best diplomats, not the ones in the State Department.
Certainly. Yeah, with occupational licensing, you could just use the my body, my choice argument. I think that's too risky product or service for you to for you to consume. Okay, my body, my choice. Offer me something better. With someone who cares so much about, you know, it's important that, homosexuals are able to, or I'm sorry, the LGBT community is able to marry who they want. Well, I think that same person should be able to shop where they want. Why is that such a stretch? But they're constantly coercively intervening in involuntary agreements. And you're correct. The right does the same thing once foreigners get involved. When it comes to artificially lowering the supply, great point you made there.
Let me just amplify on that point you make is very profound, and it's really, you know, the thing about human action is it's not really advocating the idea of economic liberty. It's really explaining how a society that's based on economic liberty operates. And I think it's important as libertarians, and what you're suggesting is that we bring up to people the overall importance of rights, like in the Declaration of Independence, natural God-given rights. And we often think of these as freedom of speech and freedom of religion, and you know, and that's the ones we're accustomed to. But that's not all the rights we have, and the Ninth Amendment makes that very clear. And that what we have to do is elevate the right of economic liberty to right there with freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and knock down these arguments from the statists that are calling for interventionism or welfare, saying this helps the poor. That if we talk in terms of economic liberty as a fundamental right that's just as important as the right to keep and bear arms, the freedom of speech, then we use Mises's book, Human Action, to explain how that right manifests itself in society in terms of higher standards of living, how a market operates in a society in which people have this right of economic liberty.
Part 6 is titled The Hampered Market Economy. He discusses regulations and the war state. And I think it goes with Part 7, The Place for Economics in Society. He discusses public opinion and narratives. Final thoughts on human action with a special focus on Part 6, The War State and the Economics of Public Opinion.
Yeah, that he's making a very important point. He says that a nation that's at war is going to have a lower standard of living. And that stands to reason. I mean, we hear this myth about, oh, World War II got us out of the Depression. That's just nonsense. War is consuming capital. The government is taxing people. It's taking their capital, their productive capital, for the purpose of armaments, guns, and whatever. And therefore, that whenever a nation is at war, its standard of living is going to be falling during the course of that war. Well, look at where we are now. We're in perpetual war. We've got a massive war state that they're now talking about making a $1 trillion economy with a $1 trillion budget for the military and the intelligence establishment. This is incredible. This is higher, even inflation adjusted, than the entire Cold War, the height of the Cold War. These people are no longer in Afghanistan killing people. That should have saved a lot of money, you would think. Oh, they're not using all those weapons. they're asking for more money, and they're getting more money because they control Congress. So you've got us now at perpetual war, all these armaments that are being furnished now to Ukraine, all the crisis with NATO. A national security state needs crises. They need official enemies. And so as we look back at this thing, and I go into this in my new book, An Encounter with Evil, that it's clear that the Cold War never ended for the CIA and the Pentagon. Never ended. The NATO started, you started using NATO to move eastward, to create more crises, absorb the Warsaw Pact countries, trying to get nuclear weapons on Russia's border, re-engender, reignite the whole anti-Soviet, anti-Russia animus, all with the idea of bigger budgets. And as Mises points out, this war society is impoverishing your country. Now, we have the benefit of having a massive base of capital that a lot of countries don't have. That's kind of a luxury where the consequences are not readily seen, because everybody says, well, you know, my standard of living is okay. But you can see hints of what's going on with the gasoline you're paying at the pump, the food you're paying for at the grocery store. And if this thing keeps going on, we're out of control spending, out of control debt, out of control inflation, you're going to see possibly actual diminutions in standard of living rather than just slower increases than what they would have otherwise been if the government hadn't done this. And so Mises provides a way for us to reevaluate everything we are as a nation. Do we want this war state? Do we want this national security state? Do we want this welfare state, the regulatory state? That's the debate that should be going on in this country. Not how do we fix this, but do we even want it at all? Do we want to restore the founding principle of economic liberty to this country and limited government?
Mm-hmm. And that's why part seven, the place for economics in society, is so important, because the thing about narratives or prevailing interpretations of past events is that people don't even think of them as opinions or worldviews. They just see them as facts of life. Look, capitalism invented poverty, America invented slavery, and capitalism started child labor. I believed all of those when I was in middle school to early high school. People just think that, and they never stop to think, okay, so before the factories, were the kids just playing hopscotch all day? What were they doing? Before the cameras showed us poverty that existed, did the poor have mansions? Did they have running water? Did they have cell phones before then? What took place? America just invented slavery, so I won't find it on any other continent at any time prior to that. This economic way of thinking about scarcity, thinking about the way ideas can transform societies, is so important because they change people's defaults, because their default is we need the state to intervene because the free market causes business cycles. Once you change that default with a general economic understanding, as opposed to the current lies that they believe, well, then you totally change what politicians are able to get away with when Joe Biden's saying that Amazon's evil, even though Amazon has a $15 an hour minimum wage and you get full benefits on day one. It's just terrible. Final thoughts on human action and public opinion.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point about the power of ideas. I mean, the fact that America went to socialism, as the rest of the world did, and even though Americans can't acknowledge that to themselves, but that's what the welfare state is, and the interventionist state, the regulatory state, and the war state. It's really the socialist concept of massive government involvement in our lives, in our economic affairs. The fact that Americans abandoned the sound founding principles of this country in terms of free markets, we know there were bad founding principles like slavery and women's rights, but there were some good ones like the free market, no income tax, no IRS, no Federal Reserve, a free market economy. They had sound money. And I would argue that we should have a free market monetary system, but certainly they brought into existence gold coins and silver coins as the official money. And so the fact that Americans abandoned that sound system that was just producing untold amounts of wealth and higher standards of living, there was a reason why thousands of people were flooding American shores every day, because there was also open immigration for 100 years, tells you everything. But the fact that that statist ideas persuaded Americans to move in the opposite direction in the 20th century should provide us hope, because that means that they can now the generations living today can go in the opposite direction, back in the direction of our sound founding principles, that ideas are powerful, ideas on liberty, one way or the other. Bad ideas can influence people, but sound ideas can influence people in the good direction. And that's where human action comes into play. Now, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone as a first introduction to free market economics from a libertarian sense. For that, I'd recommend a book called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. And then I'd recommend Bastiat's books, or at least one or two of them, Principles of Political Economy, Economic Sophisms. Economic Sophisms is a fantastic book. A little book by Bastiat called The Law. And then look at the smaller books by Mises, Planned Chaos, the Crisis of Interventionism, I think, Bureaucracy. Just go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble and you can see all the books by Mises. Tackle human action after you've read these preliminary books. That's what's going to get us back on the right road, Keith. It's these sound ideas. We've got better ideas because we have our philosophy is not only morally right because it's based on liberty, but it's also the society that raises people's standard of living, especially for those at the bottom of the economic ladder. That's what makes it so attractive to me, that you've got this mutually beneficial thing, sound moral principles and sound economic principles.
David Dorn, a mutual friend of ours, I was at an ARG meeting, one that you spoke at some time ago, and I was talking with a gentleman who had some years on me. And he was talking about how in his day, he pretty much didn't know anyone who thought that homosexuality was okay. And today, everyone he knows more or less says that it's fine. And it's nothing that people should either be ashamed of, even if you don't think that they should promote it. They don't think it's terrible. So we have seen some people, we've seen the country totally change with regard to how they see gays or even things like interracial marriage. Total drastic difference from 60 to 100 years ago. Are there any lessons we as libertarians can take away from how that shift happened and how we can change people's mind regarding the ideas of freedom?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're powerful just because they stand as examples of how things can shift. You've got people in the libertarian movement sometimes who get very depressed, very despondent how bad things are. And things are bad. I mean, things were bad before this pandemic. It just made them worse. But you never know what tomorrow's going to bring or even what today's going to bring. Just because things have been bad before doesn't mean that they're going to continue to be bad, because people can shift their positions. And the nice thing about crises is that it gives people a chance to start doing some soul searching, pondering where we are as a country. Are people happy with where we are as a country? Are they happy with the fact that we're closer to all-out nuclear destruction than we've been since the Cuban Missile Crisis? Are they happy with this constant crisis-filled environment in foreign affairs? Are they happy with their healthcare system, with their retirement system, with immigration chaos and crises, the drug war crises? I mean, there's a common denominator to most of these crises, and that's the federal government or the federal government's response to a natural crisis like a pandemic. And once people start doing some soul searching, that's where we come in. I mean, imagine how depressing life would be if there was no libertarianism, no libertarian philosophy, no Austrian economics, no human action. I mean, we're building on a foundation that's incredible. This is the most remarkable philosophy, the libertarian philosophy, that's ever been conceived in history. And it's there. All it's just a matter of having people look at it, a critical mass of people, not everyone, but a critical mass of people in society look at this thing and say, these people are right. The libertarians are right. They've been right. I'm joining up with them. I'm going to move this country in a better direction, in the direction of liberty, peace, prosperity, and harmony with the people of the world. And that's the importance of these shifts. They can always take place. And sometimes you don't have to wait decades. Sometimes they can happen instantaneously, where ideas on liberty sweep across the society like wildfire. There's a reason why totalitarian dictators like China or North Korea shut people like you and me down. You know, because here they have total power. Why do they shut people like what we're doing here down? Because they know how powerful it is. If ideas on liberty sweep across the society, they have the potential of bringing down even the most totalitarian of systems.
Excellent point. And just while I have you, we did, I believe, two fundraisers for your campaign. We were so proud to have supported you as well as the Mises Caucus in 2020. What was the biggest lesson you learned running for LP president in 2020?
That I don't like politics.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the nice thing about the educational arena is that it's somewhat genteel. I mean, we have our battles in terms of ideas and methodology. So it's not all, you know, really, I don't know, brotherly love and so forth, because we do have our battles over ideas. But boy, politics can sure get nasty. But I loved it. I mean, I loved the race. I was able to go and talk to audiences. I was really eating up speaking at all the conventions and trying to get the party into a more libertarian, pure principle direction, because I really believe that the Libertarian Party should be the party of principle. And the pandemic shut everything down, which was, to me, nightmarish, because then we started going online, which is not as much fun. But let's face it, the Libertarian Party plays a valuable role in terms of what they do, raising people's attention to what this philosophy is all about. And especially during political seasons where people are paying attention to politics and they're not paying so much attention to think tanks and educational foundations. So they play a very valuable role in advancing liberty. And so I think we all work together to reach that critical mass that's going to be bringing that shift that we all yearn for. And I want to say too, you mentioned the Mises Caucus. They were so good to me. They endorsed my candidacy, and that was a big honor for me. And every time I went to a state convention, there would always be Mises Caucus people there saying, "Mr. Hornberger, we're here to help you out. You know, let us show you around. We'll put your stuff on the chairs." And they just made me feel at home. And whenever I walked into these state conventions, and so I'm very grateful for what they did, and I'll always be grateful for the support they gave me and the fact that they endorsed me. That was quite a big honor for me.
The book is Human Action, and Mr. Hornberger's book is An Encounter with Evil, the Abraham Zapruder Story. Links will be in the description below. Mr. Hornberger, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Oh, thank you. Let me just emphasize, too, that, again, I know I said this in the beginning, but I think people would really enjoy this newest book I've written. I am really, really pleased with this. Like I said, I'm biased, but so far, all the reviews on Amazon are 5-star reviews. There were about 8 last time I checked. And I think this is a very significant contribution. At least that was my goal, to make it not only an interesting mystery story for people, but a significant contribution as to what we need to do as a necessary prerequisite to getting this nation back on the right track. So, Keith, I thank you very much. This has been a very enjoyable experience. You let me talk and you didn't interrupt me, which a lot of hosts do. And it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.